The same was going on in workplaces and professions all around the country, where people were being replaced mainly by young working class communists. There's a strong element of class in all this, and a strong element of generational struggle. Purging professors and writers and bureaucrats and engineers allowed young communists, especially from worker background, to move into positions of authority. Opening up educational institutions to workers also made it easier for lower class individuals to rise into positions of greater influence through education. But it's worth saying these were struggles not just about class, not just about generation, the young against the old, but also about ideas. There were, frankly, for many, many of these people involved in this Cultural Revolution, a desire to transform everything about life that accompanied this Industrial Revolution, this process of collectivization. Consider, for example, developments in education during the first five-year plan, such as the efforts by an educational theorist named Shulgin. He argued that everything about Soviet education during the 1920s was simply too bourgeois. It wasn't a dramatic enough transformation of life. The problem with schools, he said, is they're elitist. They're divorced from everyday life. And what was needed was what he liked to call proletarian education. Schools should turn into communes in which teachers and students worked cooperatively and not only studied together, but literally labored together. And there was an argument that part of schooling should be engagement in real productive labor. There was a very common view in these years that work with your hands, physical work, was purifying, morally uplifting, and therefore should be part of the moral education of every child. Equally interesting and telling were ideas during these same years of industrialization and collectivization among city planners. Various proposals were put forward and discussed widely in the press for a new proletarian city. Indeed, there were many national competitions to come up with these plans. These proletarian cities were all highly visionary. For example, a spiral city was suggested, or a city in the shape of a parabola. In fact, many cities were meant to have a mathematical structure, and complex formulae were shown about the origins of the city as making a city happier through science, in this case, math. A very widespread idea was the idea of linear green cities, in which there would be lines of industry followed by lines of parks and then lines of housing, and would be a more humane setting. Certain features stand out in all these various city planning ideas. One, as you can see, is a radical modernism, a reliance on science and technology, even mathematics. Electricity is very important to these city plans, modern transportation. There was great faith in the transformative possibilities of modernity in all of its aspects. At the same time, one can see what might be described as a sort of anti-modern ideal. In these city plans, a desire to get rid of the whole traditional modern city altogether, perhaps even get rid of the state as unnecessary in this new well-planned society, and in particular to create a city or a society without cities that had no compulsion, that was the ideal of what communism should be all about. And a good example of this are the ideas, rather typical of the time, of a sociologist named Akhidovich, working with two architects named Sokolov and Ginzburg. And they envisioned a socialist world in the near future that would have no permanent settlements at all. Everything was to be in motion. Power would come from a big universal grid that you can tap into anywhere. Railway stations are everywhere, as are in the air, dirigibles and airplanes flying about. It's a highly modern vision. Even housing was to be mobile. You could pick up your portable housing cell and plug it into the electric grid wherever you wanted. And you can see this is a vision of the withering away of the city, but also of the family, seen as also a type of compulsion. These were one-person housing cells, and people could come together freely in any way they wanted. It was also meant to be a collective society, but in a free and natural way. As Akhidovich, one of the designers of this plan, suggested, the stronger the collective links between people, the stronger the individual will be. And this deserves emphasis because, though these radicals all dreamed of extensive transformation, they believed that it wasn't enough to just change the external world. One had to change the inside of individuals to liberate them fundamentally. For example, one of these designers, an architect named Melnikov, suggested that all his cities needed to include sleep laboratories, where thousands of sleeping citizens would be gently inundated with these sounds and smells that were selected by scientists for their collectivist associations. However bizarre this might sound, and rather unfree, a sort of weird sort of musical and sensory brainwashing, the idea for them was that collectivism, their goal, should emerge not through force, but naturally, gradually. In other words, these were strange times, these years of Stalin's revolution, times of enormous centralized control, brutality, violence, but also times of idealism and enthusiasm and optimism, creating better lives. No wonder, then, that historians have debated so fiercely about the meanings of these particular years of the first five-year plan of Stalin's revolution. I've been to conferences where I've seen scholars literally screaming at one another over different interpretations of this period, literally breaking into tears. On the one hand, there are those who argue for the absolute totalitarian nature of the first five-year plan, the coercion, the violence, the suffering. On the other are scholars who say this isn't just a story of tyranny and victimization, though it's that, that people embraced Stalin's revolution for their own reasons, that they believed they were creating a better world. The truth, as you can see, I'm suggesting, is some combination of both, the contradictoriness of the Stalinist revolution. Next lecture, I'm going to continue this story into the 1930s, a time when the party in some way retreated from some of these radical plans, when life became in some ways more normal, more easy, more pleasant, but also a time that witnessed the most bloody coercion yet, called the Great Terror.